Ladies and gentlemen, to those among you who are easily frightened, we suggest you turn away now. To those of you who think they can take it, we say, welcome.
Told us where we stand, and Flash Gordon with fair and silver underwear, Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in a celluloid jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space, and this is how the message ran. Science fiction.
Richard, that was a fun song. It's called Science Fiction Double Feature. It's the opening song to the 1975 film The Rocky Horror Picture Show, written by Richard O'Brien, copyright 1989 Ode Records. I love that song. Coincidentally, that's one of the movies we're going to be talking about.
It is. This is the episode where we jump the shark and we're going to sing our way through the entire thing.
No singing here.
We promised our audience. No, we wouldn't make it to episode 100 if that was the case. But we are talking about horror musicals. Rocky Horror Picture Show, perhaps the most well-known out of all the horror musicals, and I think at a very, very close second, some would probably argue that it could be first or tied for first, is the other movie we're going to be talking about, and that is Phantom of the Paradise.
From 1974.
Yes, featuring the music and the voice of Mr. Paul Williams, who really is a musical legend, which we'll talk about, and is part of our Star Trek connections this month.
Ooh.
Yeah, you gotta love it.
Well, wouldn't be a complete episode without a Star Trek connection. Gosh, I don't really have much else to open with, do you, before we go into old business?
No. I think this is a fun month. When we do one of those retrospective episodes the next month, when it's just a normal month, it seems like it's so easy. Even with these movies, in which there is probably more than the usual number of notes for these films, it still pales in what we wrote for Todd Slaughter last month. If everyone is still playing catch up with Todd Slaughter, be sure to check out our respective blogs, which I guess this is the good segue as to who are we?
I was just going to say, Richard, I did think of something we could do, and that is introduce ourselves.
We never do that. I'll start it off, and I'm Richard Chamberlain from monstermoviekid.wordpress.com, and sir, you are?
Jeff Owens from classichorrors.club. Well, let's call the meeting to order then. I will bang the gavel. We've got some new members at our Facebook group page, the Classic Horrors Club podcast. This is one of those times when we have enough that Richard and I are going to alternate and welcome these people with verbal welcome versus just in the Facebook group page itself. I will start out with Aaron Anderson.
Mark Van Sickle Hurst.
Rachel Pulliam. And I'm going to pause here for a minute, Richard. Do you know Rachel?
I don't think so, but the name's sounding familiar.
I don't know her personally, but I do believe we got her from the Tara Collinwood podcast, because I know she's into Dark Shadows, and I assume that because she joined after the episode that Steve Turek and I were on. I think you would like what she does. She has an audio network, a podcast network called the Soul Twin Audio Network. That's S-O-L-E. And she does, among other things, old-time radio productions.
Ooh.
Recreations.
I'll have to check that out. That's nice.
And then she's also got a podcast called Dark Paradise, which is a merging of Dark Shadows and Strange Paradise. And then an original series called Salubrious Falls.
That's a very cool name, Salubrious Falls. I like that.
Yes.
Michael Zatz from Monster Bash.
That's right.
Michael, thank you for joining the group. Hopefully you're listening.
Michael Gallagher.
Alice Dennett.
Kristen Pierce.
And Daniel Wehagen. Hopefully I pronounced that correct.
Unless maybe from Denmark or something, it might be Wehagen.
It could be.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for joining the Facebook group page. Please feel free to participate, and we're glad to have you. We have one piece of feedback, Richard. It may strike a little close to home for you. This is from somebody called Richard Chamberlain. He was commenting on our video companion for the Todd Slaughter retrospective, and he said, great job on piecing all of these clips together. Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain, for commenting. Without that, we would have had no feedback this month.
Whoever that Mr. Chamberlain is, he sounds like a man among men, a scholar.
We are talking about Video Companion. It's on our YouTube channel, which you can find at Classic Horrors TV. Now, Richard, I don't know that I did it last time, but I usually shout out my mom and my brother for listening. I'm not sure they've been listening lately. However, in a roundabout way, I want to give a shout out to my sister because she did listen to the Terror at Collinwood podcast, which I was on. Thank you, Jill. I'm sure you're not listening to this, but thank you for listening to the other.
Hi, Jeff, sister.
You got any shout outs?
Well, a shout out and a pseudo message, I guess. The Instagram page that my daughter Kayla has started has kind of been quiet for the last couple of months. And I didn't say anything to her because I knew life has been a bit crazy. She's got two little ones now and working a full-time job. For anyone who has little ones that go to daycare, you know that they're constantly just swimming in a pool of disease. And it does seem like, especially the first couple months of the year, January and February. January was so bitterly cold everywhere. She said she's kind of getting her feet grounded again. And so this episode, there should be a post on Instagram and she'll start getting caught back up on that.
No problem. I knew it was going to be as she could do it. And what she does is great. So no problem from me. Let's tell people how they can leave us a voicemail. Maybe they'll be inspired to do it in song since we're doing a musical episode. And I think, as you usually do, you'll make a nice transition to our musical episode.
I hope.
The phone number you can call is 616-649-2582. That's
616-649. You know what I was going to do? I'm going to stop myself. I was going to say C-L-U-B. Get that anticipation thing.
Yes.
But then I just instinctively started to sing it. I ruined it for myself.
Do you want to try again? Or?
There we go. That was a horrible version.
Yeah. All right.
How can you compete against Andy Williams and Andy Williams? It's the Andy Williams show. Yeah. Paul Williams and Dr. Frankenfurter. I can't compete. I'm not in the same class.
And don't even try to compete with the costume, okay?
Well, you know, that's what the video companion's for.
We want people to watch. Don't say that.
Yeah, true.
No, I'm just kidding. All right, well, let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about our first movie, Phantom of the Paradise.
20th Century Fox presents Phantom of the Paradise, a gothic horror story.
What was that?
A beautiful love story.
Like a circus.
A cinematic odyssey through the rock universe. From Greece to glitter. Wow! And beyond. The story of a sound. The man who created it. The girl who sang it. The monster who stole it, and the phantom who haunts the paradise, the ultimate rock palace. Phantom of the Paradise.
My music is for Phoenix. Only she can sing it. Anyone else that tries dies.
Phoenix.
Phoenix.
Well, you told me one time that you'd be somebody, that you weren't working just to survive.
B.
Cast no! Whoa, whoa, wow!
man, you better get yourself a castrato for this.
Paul Williams as Swan.
And the angels that defeated them.
I want you to stop terrorizing the paradise and rewrite your cantata.
And the Phantom.
Oh, stop him, Travio! Only you might satisfy me,
the Paradise.
There really is the Phantom.
Music mogul Swan is searching for a new sound for the Paradise, his ultimate rock palace, when Winslow Leach crashes an audition and performs part of his epic cantata about Faust. Swan likes the music, but not the man. Following Swan's efforts to be rid of him, Winslow returns to haunt the theater as the Phantom.
Phantom of the Paradise, written and directed by Brian De Palma, was produced by Harbor Productions and Pressman Williams Enterprises, released in the United States November 1st, 1974 by 20th Century Fox. Richard, I believe you said this was your first time viewing. You want to tell us what you thought about it?
Believe it or not, this is my first time. I've been aware of it since the 70s. And for whatever reason, I've never sat down and watched it. And you know, I've never even seen a clip of it. I don't know how. 5 decades, I've probably been aware of this film. And
if you saw The Mask, would you have known what movie it was from?
Yes. Yeah, I had seen pictures. So I knew what The Mask was from. I knew that Paul Williams was in it. I think you gave me the soundtrack, actually. I think that was in that stack of records that you gave me.
Oh, shoot. I wish I had it now.
I'm pretty sure you did. I really enjoyed it. I'm just going to say it right now, because we always talk about which one do we like better. I like this one better than Rocky Horror. I think that from beginning to end, the movie holds up. Now, that's not to say I don't enjoy Rocky Horror. I do enjoy the heck out of that movie. It's quirky. I dig the music, though. I really enjoy the music. The music itself is certainly odd at times. Paul Williams, he's got a really good, unique voice. He's got a great talent for writing music. I have always found him to be an interesting actor, kind of quirky in the right ways. At least I've always enjoyed anything that I've seen him in. And I don't own any other Paul Williams music in my collection, but I'm very familiar with the stuff that he's written. And, you know, honestly, I say that I don't have any of his other music, but knowing a couple, I may, because I knowing at least one of the artists that he wrote for, Frank Sinatra, I do have some of Frank Sinatra's 70s music, which would have been the time that Paul Williams might have wrote for him. I didn't look and see what song Paul Williams did write. He also wrote for Ella Fitzgerald. I was exposed to Paul Williams as a kid with Rainbow Connection, Kermit the Frog, and Bugsy Malone. I used to watch Bugsy Malone all the time on HBO. That's a quirky movie. Yet I've always enjoyed that movie. Now, he sings in it. I don't think he appears in it because the entire cast is all kids, including a very young Scott Baio and Jodie Foster. It's a gangster movie with kids. So the gangster cars are all like little pedal cars, and instead of shooting them all, they're like shooting pies at each other. It's a very bizarre, bizarre movie. I was so surprised at Rod Serling's voice at the beginning as the narrator. Is that somebody pretending to be Rod Serling? No, he would have still been alive, although this was towards the end of his life, because this was released November 1st of 1974. He died on June 28th, 1975, at the age of 50 from complications of a coronary bypass. And I believe he only did one other movie after this. Again, he was like a narrator for some type of 1970s. They did a lot of those like pseudo documentary films. And I think it was one of those. I don't know what writing he was doing, but this was one of the last things that Rod Serling did. I don't know how Rod Serling got the gig. I don't know who knew him. The Twilight Zone, Night Gallery, and uncredited narration for Phantom of the Paradise. Yet, It was an awesome beginning to the film. I loved it. I had a lot of fun with it.
Great. Yeah, I've seen it many times. I love it as well. Since you talked about Paul Williams, I always think he's a little odd for that role. You don't think of evil music producer that is possibly, well, did sell his soul to the devil. I don't picture Paul Williams, but he does great in it. And he did really write all the music for the movie. So very talented. And Rod Serling, that narration is very important because without that, you wouldn't know really who Paul Williams' character, Swan, was and why he was such a big deal.
Kind of playing almost the devil part, really, right? Luring Winslow to sign the contract and luring Phoenix to sign the contract. It's not sugarcoated in any way, shape, or form. The verbiage in the contract staring at you in the face. You're selling your soul. Oh, here's some blood to sign in. But I think that's why I loved it, because everything else about the movie was so bizarre in a lot of ways. Well, of course, Paul Williams is playing the devil-like character in this, and it worked. I think if you would have had another actor legitimately playing the part in a villainous way, it wouldn't have worked. Why are we being so serious? And then, you know, the rest of the movie is clearly not as serious. Winslow Leach, like his escape from the prison, that was just a bizarre sequence. Several other things that were just juicy fruits, constantly changing from 50s doo-wop to, they kept changing their names throughout to the, I forget what the name they gave them, the Beach something or others. I've got it written down, but the Beach Bums, obviously Beach Boy wannabes, and then ending up as the Undeads, comical all the way through.
The music thing, I did listen to an interview with Brian De Palma on the Blu-ray. And did you listen to that?
I did, yes.
Okay. So the thing about it that I didn't get, but he repeated many, many times, is that this is all about music and how over time it gets diluted and changes in format or genre. And he kept saying something. He said more than once that the song in the movie is the same song over and over, just done in a different way. And I don't know that I realized that, and I still am not sure it's really the same song.
I get the idea that what he's talking about there. A lot of this was a satire almost about the music industry. The young future star who can sing always gets taken advantage of by the music industry, who signs them to these horrible contracts. That's legit. That's happened in the history of rock and roll since day one, and still does to a sad degree. That's always been one of my things why I hated American Idol, because those singers really did not get good deals. The ones who didn't win, in order to be on the show, they had to already basically sign themselves a commitment that, well, okay, you lost. Now you get to go on the American Idol tour and you're going to get a fraction of what you should be getting. They got taken advantage of very early on. This was a total take on that whole signing your soul over to the devil just to have all your fame. And then, of course, everything that goes with it. And 9 times out of 10, how many times have we seen the rising young singer with eyes full of hope and they're innocent and pure as the driven snow. And then, of course, as they achieve that fame, everything, you know, here's some drugs to keep you up. Here's some drugs to get you down. And we saw that even with the Phoenix character, right? She was doing everything she said she wouldn't do. Early on in the film, when the producer, come on in, we're going to have sex. And she goes running out. And then later on in the movie, she's looking, I'll do whatever you want to get that crowd, because she got that drug of the crowd cheering on and she loved it and she was going to do whatever it took. And she did. She had got that initial hit of fame and fortune and she needed more. And then by the end of the movie, it clearly wasn't worth it and everything comes crashing down. Timeless tale, whether you're talking the music industry or Hollywood, there's a long, long, long list since day one. This movie, for as quirky as it was, there was that message that clearly was lying underneath. There was a lot of things in this movie that paid homage to classic horror films. The title, Phantom of the Paradise, a take on Phantom of the Opera, as well as Faust. But then we had some Frankenstein in there as the body is rising up, a little bit of the picture of Dorian Gray. I read, too, that there was a homage to Edgar Allan Poe's Cask of Amontillado. Was that the brick wall?
That's what I thought.
Okay. The negative side is they got some lawsuits because of it. Brian De Palma didn't, I guess, I don't know why he didn't really stop to think about getting the rights to some of this stuff, because the estate of the Phantom of the Opera author, Gaston LaRue, filed a lawsuit. I guess it's one of those things where Phantom of the Opera, the original movie, is public domain, but I don't think, at least at the time, that the story was public domain. Now, 50 years later, it probably is public domain now, unless the Gaston LaRue estate is somehow secured. Most classic books are no longer copyrighted. Universal Pictures also somehow felt that the film was too close in an adaptation to their adaptations, and they got involved in a lawsuit. Apparently, there was also a lawsuit from King Features Syndicate because of the use of the name The Phantom, which is based on their comic strip, but there's no similarities between. There's just, it's the name. Yeah.
De Palma wanted to just call it The Phantom, and that maybe is where it got stopped.
Another big issue that they ran into in the film was the use of the name Swan Song Records. What was the final name? What was it? Was it Death? Death Records, I think, is just the name. When I heard that it was originally supposed to be Swan Song, I know my Led Zeppelin. What was he thinking? Because Swan Song Records was the name of Led Zeppelin's label. And that actually ended up being a last-minute change they had to make. The manager of Led Zeppelin got involved and actually had to like see the film to make sure that they were removing all of the Swan Song references. You know, the label was seen in numerous places, and they ended up having to do all sorts of last-minute changes to the film to eradicate the use of any visual representation of Swan Song Records. The logo didn't match, but the name did, and that was enough. There were some cases where the Death Record logo was kind of superimposed. The most noticeable one is where they're at the airport doing the press conference. I guess Brian De Palma was still young at that point and early on in his career. They only had time to do was this makeshift correction. He wasn't happy with it.
I want to go back to what you said about Phoenix, and she's played by Jessica Harper. And the credit says introducing Jessica Harper. And I'm always suspicious because we've seen that a million times when they're introducing somebody and they've already been in a movie. But this was indeed her first feature film. And she does have a great singing voice. That was really her. The thing about her, usually in a story like this, I believe you would expect the heroine to stick to her guns and not go along and not get sucked in by the producer. And in this one, she does. And for some reason, when I watched it this time, I really thought about that. And I thought Winslow still, he didn't give up on her. He still believes in her and guess kind of loves her, but at least thinks she's talented enough, should be the only one singing his songs. Yet he watches her through a skylight in bed with Paul Williams. And she does go down that road unapologetically. To me, that felt different this time.
She got that taste of fame and she succumbed to it pretty quickly. You expected maybe that she'd be forced into it somehow or tricked into it. I guess maybe she was kind of tricked into signing the contract a little bit. I found this interesting. Who she beat out for the role of Phoenix? She beat out Linda Ronstadt. Now, Jessica Harper actually had a good voice. Linda Ronstadt had a better voice, in my opinion. That particular point in time, Linda Ronstadt was smoking hot. I wonder, though, if it came down to the acting ability. I don't believe Linda Ronstadt ever did any acting. 70s was the peak of her rock music career.
Both of these movies being a musical, I don't think either one, the singing is their strong point. The songs are good, especially in Rocky Horror, but it's irrelevant how well they're singing. And in this one, certainly when he Winslow comes in at the beginning and plays his song on the piano, I didn't find him to be a decent singer at all.
No, William Finley, he reminded me of a lounge singer that you would find at the Holiday Inn out by the airport at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning. There's three drunk people in the audience, and he's sitting there playing the piano for pennies he's making and hopes that he's going to make it big. Or maybe he had the career and he ended up at the Holiday Inn. He didn't have the voice to carry it. I had to kind of laugh when the character of Beef is introduced, played by Garrett Graham. That's played off all comedically, right? But at first I'm like, wow, that's a voice there. We're going interesting. And then he gets a little better. None of that's his real voice. He was dubbed. The only time we really do hear Garrett's voice is when he's in the shower. They were filming it, and then Brian De Palma, wow, if I'd have known you were singing, we wouldn't have had to dub you. I think Garrett probably could have carried it, because singing was not Beef's strong point. He was the showman, and he was just kind of, I don't want to say screaming, but kind of scream singing his way, and that's all it took. The audience was into that.
How did you feel about him as a character? And what I'm talking about is his sort of split personality. I mean, he's got his stage presence that's a personality, and then his real is total opposite. There's, not just directed at him, but there's a couple of things in this that probably you couldn't get away with today as far as gay slurs or...
Yeah. There's definitely some very 70s references in this one. Paul Williams, the character Swan, you know, when he sees Winslow, he calls him the F word, which, you know,
get that F out of here.
That doesn't fly in today's world, and it shouldn't. Beef's character, he is the stereotypical flamboyant gay character. Not when he's on stage, though, but when he's talking, right? And he's got this manly rock persona. And then when he's talking, I just laughed. I admit that I laughed. It's like, well, that's not what I was expecting. And he was funny. At the same time, it was like this uncomfortable funny. It's not overtly offensive necessarily,
no.
But I don't think that it hurts this movie.
And it goes along with the whole satire of the music industry that you'd have this personality, and then in real life, they're the complete opposite.
Exactly.
I felt like, and it's very consistent, so I don't think it's a flaw necessarily, but there are big gaps in, I guess you could call them plot holes. It's very easy to piece together. You can kind of fill in your mind what happened. For example, we talked about him being found, Winslow being found on the bed with the girls. How did he get in there? When did he do that? And then towards the end, how did he know where that film was and to watch it? I think part of what could have been happening is that Brian De Palma wrote this with his writing partner, Louisa Rose. He had worked with her on other screenplays, particularly Sisters. And he really wanted to get this movie made, but he kind of had to shop it around. And in fact, I should have mentioned at the top, this really was finished in 72 and wasn't released until 74. But he had to make some compromises. And when he finally got someone that would put up money, Louisa Rose was not willing to make the changes that were requested. So he had to write out all of the things that she wrote. So that could explain some of the jumps. And if that's true, this does a pretty darn good job of not leaving any really huge gaping plot holes.
There's just some jumps in the narrative. I think the process of him getting into the room with all the ladies and then getting kicked out. He gets ordered to get kicked out, but we really don't see him get beat up. The cops are just there. And the next thing, he's in the lineup in the prison. And there's this whole thing about the teeth thing. I didn't really understand that.
Oh, I love that, though. They say these prisoners are volunteers for the dental hygiene program at the prison, and none of them signed up for it, but they pull all their teeth. After that, the Phantom's teeth are all silver.
Yeah,
I love that.
Kind of weird.
It's weird for sure.
The next thing, he's doing this escape routine, and then he's out, and no one's looking for him. I don't know. It was a weird jump there. But because the rest of the film is just, as my dad used to say, a couple bubbles off plum, it goes with it. You're in Bizarro World anyway, so let's just go with it. Yeah, it's got some flaws, and you just kind of look over them.
Yep. You mentioned a couple times him breaking out of prison. I really like that scene after that where it's point of view shot and you hear the heavy breathing and he's walking towards the theater. I guess I don't know what movies used that before, but that would become a very common trope in slasher movies a few years later.
Well, and there was the split screen too, which is
Very judicious use of that. De Palma sometimes really overdoes that to see the stage, what's happening on front and then what's happening off the stage at the same time. It really works in this case. It helps build the suspense.
We talked about the Juicy Fruits. I found it funny when I read that he wanted the group Sha Na Na.
But they were too hard to work with. Saw somewhere.
And I'm trying to remember, Sha Na Na did have a thing. They were a popular group in this. Remember, they even had their own TV show there for a while. And I used to watch Sha Na Na. Bowser, you know, Bowser was a funny guy. They could have been immortalized in a classic film, a cult classic, and ultimately, how many people know about Sha Na Na now? Not probably too many people. I would say they made a mistake. They should have checked their egos at the door. They could have been immortalized.
Speaking of another musical group, at the end, when the band has become, what did you say, the undead? The men come out with painted faces, white with black markings, and it immediately evoked Kiss for me. But what's interesting is that I don't even know if it coincides with Kiss's popularity. It must have been about the same time. But De Palma said he was trying instead to pay tribute to the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, I totally got that.
Yeah.
Kiss, their popularity really hit in 76 when they did their Kiss Alive album.
My favorite little bit of trivia about, well, I don't know if it's my favorite, but I just think it's really interesting. As the opening credits, I see production design Jack Fisk. Many, many years has been a production designer. And I immediately, for some reason, knew, oh, he was married to Sissy Spacek. Well, if you watch the end credits, Sissy Spacek is credited as a set dresser.
Yeah.
And if this was in the early 70s, she, I guess, was dating Jack Fisk at the time. And then they did get married in 74. And as far as I know, they're still married. They're both still working, I guess. I didn't know Sissy ever did any work. And she apparently didn't think she did a good job. And I don't know if she ever did another job like
that. Brian De Palma mentioned it briefly. Basically, she did her job so poorly. I think that's where he was talking about when they were filming some of the scenes that literally the paint was still drying because they'd gotten behind. And she kind of like ruined a day's worth of filming. Interestingly enough, though, she auditioned for the role of Phoenix, also lost out. What does Brian De Palma do? He ends up casting her in Carrie, the movie that made her a star. She wasn't made to be a set dresser, but she was obviously had other things on her career path.
And I found it interesting that De Palma credited Jack Fisk for some of the things that I wouldn't necessarily think a production designer does. I even think maybe part of the makeup or the mask or something.
The whole thing with the record press almost ended itself in tragedy because it was a real record press. It was a pressing plant, and that was like the, as was described here, an injection molding press at an Ideal Toy Company plant. So I guess they put foam pads on the press to try to protect it, that tried to resemble the casting molds. There were clocks put in the center to stop it from closing completely, but the machine was powerful enough to crush the clocks so that it kept closing. It was only because William Finley was so aware of what was going on that he was able to get his head out of the way in time, and that the scream you hear on screen is actually legit him escaping from having his head crushed. No acting there at all in that scene.
And that's such a cool scene. And after that, when he goes outside and he's crawling and his face is still smoking.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Really good scene. The makeup work, once you do get some close-up shots, left a little bit to be desired. Yeah. But the sequence where he gets injured was very well done. The smoking effect, I think, was perfect. The movie wasn't a success. Interestingly enough, it did get nominated for an Academy Award for original song, score, and adaptation. It did get a Golden Globe Award. It was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Original Score and a Motion Picture. But it was not a success. And we're going to talk about what made both of these movies a success And that's the whole midnight movie phenomenon. It was a success in Winnipeg, of all places. It played for consecutively 4 months and then on and off for another year. It had success in Winnipeg, but everywhere else it didn't find success until it hit the midnight movie circuit. Rocky Horror absolutely benefited from the midnight movie run. Phantom of the Paradise did as well, to a lesser extent.
Do you have anything on the cast members?
I do. William Finley as Winslow Leach, a.k.a. the Phantom. He was in Sisters, Eaten Alive. I still regret seeing that movie, and I even thinking about it, I need to take a shower. The Fury, The Fun House, Silent Rage, as well as an episode of Tales from the Crypt. So he's got a few other things in the horror genre that he did. Paul Williams, he's a legendary musician, and I wasn't familiar with some of these songs. I know the songs, but I didn't know that he wrote them. Old Fashioned Love Song by Three Dog Night. We've Only Just Begun by the Carpenters. Mentioned that he wrote songs for Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald. He wrote Rainbow Connection that Kermit the Frog sang. I think, if I remember correctly, he also wrote for Tony Orlando and Don. He did the music for Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, which was a kind of a perennial Christmas favorite even to this day. But then he dabbled in some other things. He dabbled in some comedic roles. He played Little Enos in Smokey and the Bandit. He is in the Planet of the Apes franchise. He played the orangutan Virgil in Battle for the Planet of the Apes in the original five films. Batman fans will remember him for being the voice of the Penguin in the animated series back in the 90s. And yes, here's the first Star Trek reference in this episode. He played the character of Koru in the Star Trek Voyager episode Virtuoso. A little bit of this and a little bit of that from Paul Williams, who is still alive and well. Jessica Harper, of course, everyone knows her for the other film, probably more so than this one, and that's Suspiria. She was also Janet Majors in Shock Treatment. If you don't know that film, we'll talk about that when we talk Rocky Horror Picture Show. She was also in Tales from the Dark Side, Tales from the Crypt, and hey, it's been a while since I've seen this film, but apparently she was in Minority Report with Tom Cruise. Garrett Graham played the character of Beef, a variety of films, a character actor in a lot of ways, a lot of TV credits. He was also in Beware the Blob, the movie Strange New World, which we talked about, the Gene Roddenberry trilogy of films in the 70s. Another film we talked about, It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive. He was also in an episode of Tales from the Crypt, an episode of Babylon 5. He was in Child's Play 2. And yes, he was in two episodes of the Star Trek franchise. He played the Hunter in the Season 1 Deep Space Nine episode Captive Pursuit. And then he was also in an episode of Star Trek Voyager where he played a suicidal member of the Q Continuum. The episode was called Death Wish.
He also starred in a movie called National Lampoon's Class Reunion, which coincidentally I watched last week for my TV Terror Guide feature. And he and the movie are god-awful.
When you said National Lampoon's Class Reunion, I think, well, I think the only good National Lampoon movies are the vacation movies, because I know that their name was slapped on a lot of other bad films. And I'm pretty sure Class Reunion, and you confirmed it. George Mamoli, he played Philbin, which I think was the road manager, right?
Yep.
A handful of roles. Most notable was in Rocky. He did some TV stuff as well. He died in 1985 at the age of 46, which would have made him in his early 30s in this movie. He looked older than that already.
Yeah.
So I would have said he was 50.
And his character name, Philbin, is, I don't know if it was purposely taken, but Mary Philbin starred in the original Phantom of the Opera in 1925.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't catch that. We've talked a little bit about Brian De Palma, who wrote and directed the film. 42 credits. I would have thought he would have had more film credits. Brian De Palma is still making movies today, although he's no longer in the spotlight, I think, for most of the films he's doing. He's kind of left that spotlight, but he did do Sisters and The Fury and Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Scarface, Body Double, The Untouchables. Very hot in the 70s and 80s. That's all I had for the cast. I don't think I had anything unless you had anything else.
Nope, I believe I was able to express all of my information.
I thoroughly enjoyed this. The Blu-ray, less than $20. It's still available from Scream Factory. You can stream it on Fubo or rent to, or buy on Amazon, Apple TV. But if you even remotely think you'll enjoy this movie, get the Blu-ray for less than $20. Add it to your collection. You'll enjoy it. It's something that I know I'll be watching again. Well-deserving of its cult classic status.
Yes, and we didn't even mention it runs just 91 minutes and that it just clips along. There's not a dull moment, I don't think.
I think it's a perfect running time. It has a solid ending to it, I think. It doesn't fall apart really at any point in the film. I can't say the same for our next film.
Well, we'll take a break and we'll come back and hear just exactly what you do have to say about it.
You've seen all kinds of movies, but you've never seen anything like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Let's do the time warp again. Let's do the time warp again.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show is wonderfully weird.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own.
It's fabulously freaky. It's a trip to transsexual Transylvania.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I'm transsexual Transylvania.
The story is strange.
But tonight is the night. And my beautiful creature is destined to be born!
The songs are super.
Science fiction.
The scenery is smashing. The cast is completely crazy.
Junior Chamber of Commerce, Brad.
There's a mad scientist named Frank N. Furter.
Come up to the lab and see what's on the slab.
And Rocky, his incredible creature.
He was in with a bad crowd, but it was worse than I imagined.
A sinister servant named Riffraff.
I remember doing the time warp!
And Brad and Janet.
My name's Brad Majors.
Just a couple of clean-cut kids.
This is my fiancée, Janet Weiss.
Touch me. I wanna be dirty.
Eddie. Magenta.
When shall we report to Transylvania, huh?
Columbia. Dr. Scott.
Great Scott!
So give yourself over to absolute pleasure. See the Rocky Horror Picture Show. You've never seen anything like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Let's do the time warp again. Let's do the time warp again.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show is wonderfully weird.
After their car has a blowout during a rainstorm, straight-laced and newly engaged couple Brad Majors and Janet Weiss knock on the door of the castle they passed earlier, looking for a telephone. They find themselves in the middle of the annual Transylvanian convention and meet a colorful cast of sexually fluid characters that challenge their moral codes.
Richard, there are a few different release dates for Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's not actually entirely an American film. It was also UK and it was made in the UK. So therefore it came out earlier there. However, I do believe you've prepared a little something for what was happening in the world of entertainment when it was released here in the United States?
Yes, I have. September 26, 1975 is what I had as the U.S. release date, or at least I think the primary release date. So I chose that time period. Musically, 1975 was an interesting time. There was a little bit of this and a little bit of that on the Billboard Hot 100. The week of September 27th, 1975, songs rising up on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. We had a song called Miracles by Jefferson Starship. Jefferson Airplane had gone through some changes. They were now calling themselves Jefferson Starship. I love the song Miracles. Also popular on the charts was the theme from Jaws by John Williams. It's because Jaws was a big hit in 1975. Lion Eyes by the Eagles. Eagles were in their prime, mid-1970s. They were cranking out the hits. Also, John Fogerty had a solo hit, Rockin' All Over the World. All right, here is the top 10. At number 10, we have Feel Like Makin' Love by Bad Company. Solid rock tune of 75. Number 9, Ballroom Blitz by the band Sweet. Then number 8, this is where things get a bit schizophrenic. I so want to sing this, but I couldn't do it justice. Ladies and gentlemen, Wasted Days and Wasted Nights by Freddie Fender. That's what the 70s was all about. And you can have Feel Like Making Love by Bad Company, and two positions later, it's Freddie Fender. Number 7, At 17 by Janice Ian. Number 6, Barry Manilow, very hot in the 70s. Could It Be Magic at number 6. Number 5, Run Joey Run by David Geddes.
Love that.
Number 4, Fight the Power by the Isley Brothers. Number 3, I love the heck out of this song when it came out. This song would be on the radio. I had to listen to it, and I would sing it because I knew all the words. Rhinestone Cowboy by Glenn Campbell.
Yeah.
And then we go to some glam rock at number 2, Fame by David Bowie. And then at number 1, keeping up with the schizophrenic 70s trend, we have I'm Sorry, Calypso by Mr. John Denver. Box office for the week of September 24th, 1975. You want to take a guess what the number 1 movie was?
Jaws.
It was. Jaws was number 1 for the 14th consecutive and final week.
Knocked it off, do you know?
This is one I don't know, mostly because it doesn't surprise me when I look at the cast. Love and Death, starring Woody Allen and Diane Keaton. I'm not a big Woody Allen fan. Not familiar with that one. But that was what displaced it the following week.
Wow.
Other top movies of 1975 included The Towering Inferno, which we've talked about. Young Frankenstein, which we've talked about, The Godfather Part 2, and The Happy Hooker. Believe it or not, Happy Hooker was one of the top movies of the year.
Yeah.
Other horror films in 1975 included Bug, which was the last film William Castle produced, The Devil's Reign, which we've talked about here, Mr. Ernest Borgnine, William Shatner, and all sorts of other people, The Ghoul, which I believe that stars Peter Cushing, doesn't it? The Ghoul?
I believe, yeah.
Because also we have Legend of the Werewolf, which also starred Peter Cushing. Trilogy of Terror, which technically was a TV movie, but did get released theatrically, I guess, in some areas. Jaws. Jaws is a horror movie. It counts, sort of. It's at that fringe, right?
Yeah.
It's the umbrella, and it sits hanging out there at the edge of the water. Night of the Seagulls, which was the fourth film in the Blind Dead series. We have The Werewolf and the Yeti with Mr. Paul Naschy. And then a film you have talked about, The Werewolf of Woodstock. You covered that on your blog not too long ago. If we didn't want to listen to music, we didn't want to go to the movies, we were staying home on a Saturday night, September 25th, 1975, over at ABC. Fall season. We had all new shows everywhere. No repeats. We had Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell. We had SWAT. I love the theme song probably more than the TV show, but I used to watch the show. And Matt Helm, this was a short-lived 13-episode adaptation of the Matt Helm character. Over at NBC Saturday night, we had Emergency. And then, of course, the Saturday night movie was The Man Who Loved Cat Dancing from 1973.
Burt Reynolds.
And over at CBS, a lot of these things, I know we've talked about all these before. The Jeffersons, the short-lived series Doc with Bernard Hughes, which I think ran two seasons. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Bob Newhart Show, and...
Carol Burnett.
There we go.
Yeah, there we go.
That's what was on television in 1975.
Well, thank you very much for that. Let's take a... Well, we're not taking another break. Let's go right into Rocky Horror Picture Show. We already talked about its release date. I will just add that the UK date was a little over a month earlier, August 14th in 1975. But it was written by Jim Sharman and Richard O'Brien, based on the original musical play by Richard O'Brien and directed by Jim Sharman. Production company was 20th Century Fox and Michael White Productions. Running time, 100 minutes. Richard, you got to start this off. I don't know how to start off talking about this.
I will start off.
Not because of the movie itself, but just because of the phenomenon.
Well, I will start off by saying if anyone hears this beeping sound in the background, it's because it's a beautiful spring day here. The window is open here at the southern branch of the Classic Horror Club podcast studios. And somebody's backing up in the neighborhood, apparently. So
their forklift? Or
I have no clue. I can't see it. I'm just hearing it. The Rocky Horror Picture Show. What a unique film. I've never seen it as a stage production. But as a film, this movie really benefits from a live audience, and it benefits from audience participation. As it is, when you watch it strictly as a film, it absolutely, I mean, it's an entertaining film. It's got a lot of catchy musical numbers that get played throughout every Halloween sequence, right? Time Warp, everybody knows Time Warp. Sweet Transvestite from Transylvania would get played as well. So there's a lot of catchy songs. In the first three quarters of the film, you've got a really well put together cast of oddball characters. I think Tim Curry, the young Tim Curry, absolutely nails the part of Dr. Frankenfurter. He owns that role to the extent that I know there was a time period after the movie that he didn't want to come back and play it again, because we'll talk about there was talk of a potential sequel. And I don't say he was embarrassed by the role, but he was ready to leave it in the past. As he got older and the movie continued to gain in popularity, and especially once it became available on home media and such, he began to embrace the role a little bit more, to the extent that he was involved in the 2016 ill-fated made-for-television production, by which point, obviously, Tim Curry was much older. He had suffered a stroke in 2012, so he ends up playing the criminologist role in that adaptation. I've seen this film enough that I just can't see anybody else playing the character, and so when I did see clips from the 2016 television version featuring Laverne Cox, it just doesn't work for me at all. But I think some of the other cast members are really what makes the film complete in that sense, because I think that Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon as Brad and Janet, they do incredibly well in their roles. A young, somewhat innocent Susan Sarandon. There's moments where she's obviously not so innocent. Barry Bostwick plays the dumb Brad Majors incredibly well. Richard O'Brien is Riff Raff. He owns that role. But then you've also got like the quirky character of Columbia, played by little Nell Campbell. Patricia Quinn is Magenta. I'm going through the cast early because it's just, I think, talking about these characters, you got to give credit to the actors who played them, as well as some of the supporting characters. Like, I don't know how Charles Gray got associated with this movie, but he plays the criminologist. a young Meatloaf before he was singing about Paradise by the Dashboard Light, playing the character of Eddie. A lot of great quirky acting goes into this with the quirky setting, the quirky story, and the music. It really does work for me for about three quarters of the way through. I saw this originally. My first experience was going to a midnight movie presentation of this back, I believe, 86 time period. I'm trying to remember. I don't think my mom and dad would have let me go to a midnight movie in the big city until I was out of high school. So probably the summer of 86 is when that time frame would have been. We went to the Pawnee 4 Theater on South Broadway. Now, let me tell you, South Broadway was not the best part of town. It could be argued that South Broadway was probably the second worst place in town. The worst place was 21st and Hillside, which happened to be where I went to college. When I went to college, I would go to sleep to the gunshots off in the distance and the police helicopters above. We were instructed not to go a block one direction or the other from the parking lot of the dorm that we lived in. So going to the Pawnee Theater on South Broadway, I had never been on South Broadway because my parents certainly weren't going to take me on South Broadway. This was where you would find the ladies of the night walking the street. My first time ever seeing that. The motels that advertised the hourly rates. And then the Pawnee Theater, I mean, that it was part of an old shopping strip that had seen better days. The Pawnee Theater was probably the bottom of the barrel theater. It was the grindhouse theaters. It probably was okay enough during the day, but once the night went down, I mean, a whole different clientele went to these theaters. And it was an experience for this young, naive yet lad from the Midwest in the big city. Audience participation, which we had talked about with me and my friends. Somebody had done the research. We had all of our accessories, right? The newspaper and the rice, and I forget the other accessories. I've got the list of stuff here that you were supposed to take. There was the rice to be thrown at the wedding. Water pistols, the back row squirts them during the rain scene. I don't remember that. Rubber gloves, when Frankenfurter snaps his gloves on. There was the toilet paper, preferably Scott's brand, which is when Brad yells, "Great Scott!" And then you throw the toilet paper. Confetti, I'm pretty sure we had that. Toast, yes, we had toast that was thrown when Frank proposes a toast at dinner. Party hat during Rocky Horror's happy birthday. The bell, when they say, you know, when we made it, did you hear a bell ring? And there were cards. There was a prop for there's a light. In the 70s, people would take cigarette lighters, but later on when smoking in theaters was banned, some people said they used flashlights, newspapers. I don't know. I can try to remember all the things we took, but we did take a handful of stuff. And then, of course, there was people in the audience participating who had seen the movie a gazillion times. There was people in front, and this was midnight. And it was a bizarre experience, a very eclectic, very interesting clientele. It sticks with me vividly, that experience. I never went to a midnight movie again, although I wanted to. The only other theater experience that I had that even comes close to comparing this was probably about a year later when I went into an X-rated theater in Wichita. And I went with my friend and my girlfriend, and that was in itself an experience. The clientele for the Rocky Horror Picture Show was pretty pale in comparison to what I saw. I compare these because the whole experience of that type of movie-going experience is not something that really exists anymore. Theaters don't allow it. X-rated theaters really don't exist anymore because everything's on the internet and midnight movie culture doesn't really exist anymore. It died out with the advent, really, of so many of the movies that were popular on midnight movie circuit becoming available on VHS or DVD. A lot of the movies that the cult movies that people couldn't see anywhere else. For example, a lot of kung fu movies would play in the midnight movie circuit, the biggest, most popular of which was Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon. These two particular films that we talk in this week, I found a particular ad from an LA theater in, I think, May of 1978 They were playing on a double feature with a musical act, and it was the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, which was the original name, early appearance for Oingo Boingo, the Weird Science Guys. My first experience was amazing to this. And then I bought the VHS in 1990, and it was a totally different experience because the audience participation wasn't there. Now I'm just watching the movie as a movie, and it does lose something when you just watch it as a movie. If you ever have an opportunity to see this with an audience that knows what they're doing with it, I would strongly suggest you go and experience it that way. It'll be so much better than just watching it at home. What was your experience with the movie? I'll shut up now.
I will say that last night when I watched it was the first time I've been awake the entire time. And that is the problem for me. I've gone to see it several times, but I don't do good with midnight movies. I cannot stay awake, even with the activity. I must say also my first time was in college. Perhaps there was something that would cause me not to remember very well. I thought in my mind it was a bad movie, and I was really leery of watching it at home by myself. There were parts of it I had forgotten if I ever knew that I really, really liked. I'm with you, though, about the three quarters. And I'm curious if there's something specific that happens for you or if you just kind of think it peters out.
Honestly, and this might be blasphemy for those who really enjoy this film, but I think the movie falls apart in that last act simply because the fun and quirkiness kind of disappears. And the quality of the music just doesn't hold up for me. I'm looking at the list of songs. The title track, Science Fiction Double Feature, what a great start to the film. Damn It, Janet, fun song. Over at the Frankenstein Place, The Time Warp, Sweet Transvestite, The Sword of Damocles. That was stuck in my head for a couple of days when Rocky is singing the Sword of Damocles over my head. Hot Patootie. I love Meatloaf. Hot Patootie, Bless My Soul. Touch a Touch a Touch Me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, great stuff. You get to the final songs when they really build up to the big I'm going home, and you got the chorus show. That whole segment, I don't know, it doesn't seem as fun anymore. It's quirky, but Frankenfurter's eccentricity and goofiness takes a turn, and then as the movie begins to wrap up, and we kind of get the whole, spoiler alert, space aliens, and they're taking the Frankenfurter back home, and people are dying in the pool, and I don't know. The ending was okay, but it falls flat for me, the ending does, and the music isn't anywhere near as good as what happens in the first three quarters of the movie. And maybe it's just there's just been so many crazy things. I reach a point of I either need the same level to keep me going. I'm kind of getting exhausted here. Give me a big finale. And I personally don't think the finale hits it on all cylinders.
I agree. That pretty much explains how I feel about it.
Our good friend Steve Turek and Miss Penny Dreadful covered this show over at the Diecast Movie Podcast. He gave us a shout out. I will wholeheartedly give them a shout out. Now, as we're recording, the episode just dropped, so I have not had a chance to listen to it. And I almost did it intentionally because I didn't want to listen until we recorded ours. I'm sure they're taking a different take on it than we are. I strongly recommend that people have their own science fiction double feature and listen to their show, listen to our show. Steve does a wonderful job over at his show, and I'm anxious to hear what they have to say. I don't know that that's what I felt when I watched it the first time, but I know that every other time that I've watched it, I've felt the same way. I suspect that when I saw it in the theater, I was probably getting tired by the time we got to the final act. This is the first time I'd watched it with a critical eye.
You may have mentioned, I forget, have you ever seen the stage show?
No, I never have.
Okay, I have once in Kansas City. And it was good. I don't remember, though, if that's how it ended. Wasn't the play originally like only 20 minutes long or something?
It was 40 minutes.
40, yeah. Okay.
Would a 40-minute running time be better? Maybe.
That's too short.
You're right. It's too short. This runs about 90 minutes, too, roughly. If you shave off about 30 minutes, you'd have a pretty solid hour running time. You'd probably have to run through that opening scene at the wedding probably a little quicker. Really, once they get to the mansion, it's just kind of like bam, 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 bam. It's just like one thing after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other. And then it just kind of like, okay, we're going to ease things. Basically, when they have the dinner, when they get together for the dinner, that's when things slow down. And that's when Frankenfurter, in my mind, goes from being kind of this lighthearted, kind of fun, jovial character, because he's building himself a man. And now all of a sudden, you know, because of course, by that point, he's snuck in to Brad and Janet's boudoir, and which scenes are hilarious. I love it. When he has a dinner, yeah, now Frankenfurter's a little ticked off. He's a little jealous.
And then when they go back up to the lab, that's where I think then, I'm not really sure what the plot is at that point. I don't feel like it's moving forward necessarily.
Maybe that's where like the whole, what's really going on is that you got the whole space alien thing going on. I think that's where, to me, is like, I don't know. I kind of just liked when it was just a whole series of quirky things happening. I didn't need to know much plot other than Frankenfurter's built himself a man. And he's surrounded by a lot of crazy people who break out in song and dance. Frankenfurter, yeah, he's a little testy. When Janet says she's not really into guys with muscles or whatever, you know, I was like, well, yeah, well, I didn't make him for you, Janet, you know. I love that. That's, to me, is like, okay, that's a little edge to him, but it was funny. It became almost a little sad towards the end, right? Because if you like the Frankenfurter character, it doesn't really end well for him necessarily. I don't know. I didn't like the whole space alien thing.
I understand.
It just kind of seemed out of place with all the rest of the stuff. I don't know how I would have ended it. I haven't really given that any thought, but kind of think there was maybe another way. Comparing to Phantom of the Paradise, I think that movie is solid from beginning to end. It doesn't fall apart, in my honest opinion.
Yes. Do you want to go back to that song and list the movies that are referenced in it?
Yes, yeah, so the opening numbers...
Should we trade off like we did for new members?
If you want to, let's see.
I'm sure we're looking at the same list. So
we might start, be.
You start out and we'll see.
Michael Rennie was ill in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
I'm not going to be able to add any embellishments, but I'll just say Flash Gordon.
Yes, we have The Invisible Man.
King Kong. And was it? And Fay Wray was mentioned in a later song, right? I thought... It was going to be a reprise of this, and it was a different song, but I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right. Yeah, I'm trying to remember, but I think you are correct. It Came from Outer Space.
Dr. X.
I love It Came from Outer Space. That's such a fun film. Sorry. It's Forbidden Planet.
Tarantula. And I really liked, these are smart references. Like they talk about Leo Carroll and how he, something in Tarantula. I mean, it's fantastic.
Well, the interesting thing is, I think more people would have known all of this in 1975, whereas you jump ahead 50 years and only people like you and me are going to get most of these references. I think mainstream.
I wonder if they update those any, like in the 2016 version, if they change the lyrics to reflect.
I hope not, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
The Day of the Triffids.
Curse of the Demon.
And When Worlds Collide. A lot of fun stuff. A lot of fun references. That's an awesome way to kickstart that movie.
You mentioned Charles Gray. Did you say anything else about him at the time? First of all, I just love that role. Just out of nowhere, goes back and forth. And the way he participates in Time Warp, it's fantastic. He's so familiar. You don't really know where you've seen him. The Devil Rides Out.
Yeah. And honestly,
and I'm sure other things, but for me, that's what stands out.
This is where you know that you've married the right person when you're sitting there watching a movie and Carla's looking, she says, I know that guy. He's Blofeld. Yes. Yes, he is. Ernst Stavro Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever. He was also Mycroft Holmes in The 7% Solution. He was also in The Beast Must Die, which we mentioned, and Theater of Blood. He was in a lot more films than I thought. And he was also in Shock Treatment. Mm-hmm. He played Judge Oliver Wright. So whatever got him to do Rocky Horror Picture Show, apparently he needed the money, or they were able, somebody was friends, I don't know, but he came back in the pseudo spin-off sequel Shock Treatment, which is...
Well, let me ask you this. How would you feel if Vincent Price had played that part?
I saw that. Man, that would have been interesting. I think Vincent would have played the role with tongue-in-cheek, like he did in the Fives movies a little bit, or like Theater of Blood, that early to mid-70s Vincent Price, where he was just kind of going with it and just getting away with playing it in kind of a cheesy way, because he was just Vincent Price and had such a good look and a good voice. He would have added a measure of horror cred to this movie. I would be as bold as to say that I think Rocky Horror Picture Show would have secured a bigger spot in horror-dom, in the horror genre, whatever you want to say it. I think the movie would be like, well, yeah, this is a Vincent Price film. Even though he only had a small role, can you imagine Vincent Price doing the Time Warp, though? I mean, I honestly can't, because he was that kind of fun guy. He never take himself too serious. I don't know that it would have helped the movie, you know, necessarily, other than just the name and his
cred
on screen, the cred to a whole nother level.
How would you feel if a young up-and-coming Steve Martin had played Brad Majors? I don't know that he was really under consideration, but he did audition.
Gosh, was there ever a young Steve Martin?
There was, I remember.
That would have been interesting.
And he does, of course, show up in a horror musical later, because he's the dentist in Little Shop of Horrors.
Does. Yes, he does.
And do you know the other musical, not horror, also plays a dentist?
Drawing a blank.
Dr. Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Oh, yes.
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
On his head. Okay. I love that song. This is another one. Am I stealing your thunder if I...
Nope, that's the only two I had.
Okay, well, can you imagine Mick Jagger playing Dr. Frankenfurter?
I think I could. And yeah, this is interesting. So the studio wanted them to have, not that Steve Martin at the time was a big star, but there are other people you're probably going to list that were considered. The studio wanted them. They wanted a big draw, and the creators, Sharman and everyone, refused. And so they still got to make the movie, but their budget was cut because they didn't have a big star.
I don't know. Mick Jagger, man. Tim Curry owns the role. And yeah. In my head, Tim Curry is Dr. Frankenfurter. So I'm trying to imagine Mick Jagger. And then I start imagining Mick Jagger in drag. And no, I don't. The world needs to see that. For some reason, I don't see it. I liked how in the opening wedding scene, we see Tim Curry, a.k.a. Frankenfurter, is the minister. You've got Riff Raff as the old man to the left. You have his wife is Magenta. Then Columbia is dusting or something inside the church.
And then later when the criminologist first comes on, he's got a black and white photo with their faces circled.
Yes, yes. Were they really the same characters all along?
That's what I thought, that they were there. I thought they were maybe hunting for victims or bodies or something, because it was right by the cemetery.
They seem surprised when Brad and Janet show up, but then again, do they? Because
yeah,
there's the flat tire, and he has that line, you know, you had a flat, how about that? To me, always implied, yeah, we wanted you here. Although I'm not sure why they wanted them there, the way the rest of the plays out. Because at times they do act like they're just kind of like, well, you just happen to be here at the right time. I don't know. They kind of bounced around as that. Was this planned? Was it not? It does kind of seem in some ways that it was, and then in other ways it wasn't. The movie was released in 1990. It was in the early days of VHS, where I know that Rocky Horror was, when I worked at the video store in 1988, Rocky Horror, we had a list of like the most wanted movies on VHS. Rocky Horror was on the list. McClintock, the John Wayne film, which was not available at that point, was high on the list. And this was right at the dawn of movies being priced to own. When VHS first came out, movies were $89, $90, $100 a pop. People did buy them, but they were rich people. I mean, most people didn't even have a VCR in their home until later in the 80s, really. because people would rent them from the video store or from your grocery store that had videos there. When E.T. got released in 1988, it was such this huge spectacle. If you recall, you had to pre-order and pay, and then you came in and got your copy when it arrived. And that proved that there was a market for people to buy videotapes at a cheap price. And then so gradually the prices were going down. And then Rocky Horror gets released in 1990. It hurt Rocky Horror, whereas the home media market helped Phantom of the Paradise, because that was a movie that didn't need the audience participation. It just needed to be seen.
Do you recall or do you know how well it did on home video? Did they sell a lot?
I remember it sold well initially because there was a lot of people that wanted it, people who had seen it. I remember at the time that there was just a lot of talk about, it's not as fun as I remembered because you don't have the audience participating. Even if you watch a version of it where there's an audience that you see watching the movie, which is kind of what they try to do in the 2016 TV version, it's hard to recreate that. Sometimes there's a magic of watching a movie in a theater that you just can't quite recreate in a home setting.
So tell us, how in the world did a sequel, well, not a sequel, a pseudo sequel maybe?
Well,
what's the story of that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things here. Richard O'Brien, his initial draft was called Rocky Horror Shows His Heels, and he wrote it in 1979. He had all the characters coming back. He wanted to bring all the original production team and cast back, but Jim Sharman didn't want anything to do with it, and Tim Curry didn't want to reprise his role. It died, and then he took some of those ideas and then went ahead and did Shock Treatment in 1981. He was with Jim Sharman again. It's a standalone film. It's not a sequel. It has a little continuity because it has the characters of Brad and Janet Majors. They're now married. They're still living in Denton.
Is that Texas, by the way? Is it Denton, Texas?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And I've never seen Shock Treatment. I've often forgot about it, but I really kind of want to see it now just because I know that it's a movie that was not well received for a wide variety of reasons. Some songs that were going to be part of Rocky Horror Shows His Heels that got pulled in. It was originally going to be called The Brad and Janet Show. Initially, critics and audiences really didn't care for it because it was missing Tim Curry. It was missing the original Brad and Janet. This is a movie, though, that it kind of had it gained into cult status. I believe it played on the midnight movie circuit as well. Not to the success of Rocky Horror, but it gained a following. And it's a movie that as years have gone on, more people are, I guess, recognizing it that there's something there. Richard O'Brien has tried a few times to kind of revisit the idea. He looked at doing a sequel again in 1991. Apparently it was going to be called Revenge of the Old Queen. It got as far as pre-production, but then 20th Century Fox studio head Joe Roth was eventually ousted in 1993, and then it got shelved because apparently he was behind it and the new regime was not. Apparently you can find bootleg copies of the script online, I guess. There's also a song from the original demo tape that is out there. I don't know if it's online, but apparently it's gotten in the hands of certain fans. So some of it got out there, but it's all remains property of 20th Century Fox. He tried again about between 99 and 2000 to do yet another attempt at it, and it was going to be called Rocky Horror, The Second Coming. This was originally intended as a stage play and then with the option that it was going to be potentially adapted into a feature film. He got as far as a first draft and then couldn't finalize anything beyond that initial draft, and it went back into development hell, and that pretty much is where it died now more than 20 years ago. There's been obvious stage plays and stuff of Rocky Horror, but the closest that there's been any modern day version was the 2016 television special, but that was strictly a remake, if you will, of the original. I think at this point, many of the cast, they're gone or they've gotten a lot older. Tim Curry, if he even wanted to be involved in it, he couldn't play Frankenfurter anymore. Any opportunity to do a sequel, I think even 20, 25 years ago would have been pushing it, to be honest with you, because at that point, it would have been 25 years since the original. And now, of course, you're looking at 50 years. I think that ship has sailed.
Did you dig deeper into the cast or not? I guess you mentioned at the first you...
I'll go over the cast here real quick.
Okay.
Something interesting that I found out about Tim Curry. 242 credits, and he's still working. He is still doing some stuff. Home Alone 2, he's well known for that role as the hotel concierge, whoever, who's after Macaulay Culkin's character. He was also in Congo and Clue, the Earth 2 television series, which I loved, and then it got canceled after season one and left on a cliffhanger. No one watches that show now, because why would you? There's no conclusion. The Hunt for Red October, Legend. He was also a voice actor. He became very prolific in that. And this is where I did not know that he was originally cast as the Joker in Batman the Animated Series.
Hmm.
Okay, you didn't know this either.
No, I didn't.
I had this conversation with Steve Turks. Apparently, he did know this.
Of course he did.
And you can actually hear some audio clips on YouTube, so seek it out. He recorded 4 episodes, and then he parted ways. How he parted ways, supposedly he said at one point that he got bronchitis and decided to leave the role. There is a little mini documentary out there. I'm assuming maybe it's from one of the DVD or Blu-ray sets. The producers did not blame Tim Curry because they didn't really know what they wanted to do with the Joker role, but they knew that what he'd do was not it. Susan Sarandon, 156 credits, still going strong. Thelma and Louise, I think that's her big movie. Other films, Bull Durham, Witches of Eastwick, more recently, Blue Beetle. I think she was she the villain in Blue Beetle?
Yes.
Or villainous character?
I think so.
Okay. Barry Bostwick played Brad Majors, 186 credits, still going. Not a whole lot in the genre, but he did do Megaforce in 1982, which I remember going to the theaters and seeing Megaforce. I've not seen it since 1982. He also does one of the voices in the amazing film Fantastic Planet from 1973. Richard O'Brien, who played Riff Raff, a few oddball credits. He was the character of Dr. Cosmo McKinley in Shock Treatment. He was also in the movie Dark City, as well as in the 1980 version of Flash Gordon. Patricia Quinn, who played Magenta, she was in lots of British television. She was also in the movie Lords of Salem. She was in an episode of Hammer House of Horror. She was in the 1977 BBC television production of A Christmas Carol. And here's our Doctor Who reference. She was in a Seventh Doctor Sylvester McCoy story called Dragonfire. Little Nell Campbell played Columbia. Not a lot of credits, 28. This is her most famous role. She did play the character of Nurse Ansalong in Shock Treatment. Magenta was in Shock Treatment, too. I might not have mentioned that. I should have mentioned that. Little Nell Campbell was also in Pink Floyd the Wall, which is another popular midnight movie. Jonathan Adams played the character of Dr. Everett Scott. Lots of British television for him. That's about what he's known for.
Did you read the little tidbit that in the play, the actor who plays Eddie also plays who you just mentioned, and that makes the connection that he's his nephew because they sort of look alike. They did not want, Meatloaf thought he could do it, but they went a different way.
Different way. And probably smart, honestly. Let's mention Meatloaf. He played the character of Eddie. This was really before he became well known for his music. It was shortly after this, he did his Bat Out of Hell album, which skyrocketed, became a huge selling hit for him, including Paradise by the Dashboard Light, smash hit. He was also in an episode of Masters of Horror, so a little bit of horror cred there. And last but not least, Peter Hinwood as Rocky Horror. You know, you got the gist that he wasn't a great actor, and, well, he only has 4 credits, and this is one of them. That's probably what you need to know about him.
He did not need to be a great actor.
He did not. He just needed to be a pretty boy, and that's what he was. Jim Sharman. Not a lot of other credits for him. 6 movies, 5 of which he also did the writing for. So this is what he's known for by far. Koo Stark, appeared as one of the bridesmaids.
I saw that. Now refresh me who Coos Stark is. I know the name's very familiar.
I know the name's very familiar, and I tried to do some research, and I'm like, what am I missing in the research? I could not find, but I'm like, there's something about Coos Stark. I know that name, but there was nothing that in my initial research. So obviously where I was researching was not giving me what I need to know about Coos Stark. It did pull up a Doctor Who reference. She apparently was supposed to be in the 1985 Doctor Who episode Attack of the Cybermen. She was replaced at the last minute due to a disagreement with the production team. Here's a couple of other funny little tidbits, though. There's a couple scenes where Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick unintentionally hurt themselves. You won't know it unless you're looking at it. There's a scene at the dinner table there in the and kind of towards the last, you know, quarter of the film where Brad slams his hand down on the table. Well, he actually slams his hand on Susan Sarandon's hand, and you see this reaction on her face. That's because he hurt her hand. And then later in the movie, when they're doing the chorus line routine, and I don't know if she did this intentionally or by accident, but with her heels, she steps on his foot and he reacts accordingly. Kind of fun now that you know these little things.
Yeah.
Also, take it with a grain of salt for whatever it is. Apparently on an episode of NPR program Fresh Air, hosted by Terry Gross, Tim Curry said that he got to meet King Charles III, who was then only Prince Charles, and Princess Diana because she loved Curry in the movie. She requested the meeting when he was in a production of Love for Love. Curry recalled that he was placed at the end of the receiving line, and while Prince Charles only vaguely recognized Curry from having seen him on television, Princess Diana told Curry with a wicked smile that Rocky Horror had quite completed my education.
I usually take notes when I'm watching a movie if we're going to talk about, and I decided not to do that. I just wanted to sit back and just kind of see what it was like to experience it at home. So I don't really have much else to add either. Just a lot of little pieces of it that I absolutely adore. But like we've said 100 times, it just doesn't really quite make it to the end.
Honestly, I think, you know, you could stop at the dinner and just say, okay, everyone lives happily ever after, and you're good. You can get it on Blu-ray for less than $20. Both of these movies are really easy to find. I would recommend both movies wholeheartedly. Rocky Horror is good for the Halloween season, absolutely. Certainly something fun to have on the background at a party or something. Get people involved when the songs come up.
Very fun talking about those two, something a little bit different. Let's take a final break, and we'll come back and see if we can scrounge up some new business.
So, come up to the lab and see what's on the slab. I see you shiver with anticipation. But maybe the rain is really to blame. So I'll remove the cause, but not the symptom.
Richard, I mentioned scrounging up new business, I guess partially because we recorded so recently. There's really nothing new to report. I couldn't find any new releases of interest that we haven't talked about. The only thing is there seem to be quite a few sales going on about this time.
Yeah, apparently, and I don't know how long, so by the time you hear this, it may be gone. Hopefully, it lasts a little bit longer. According to the Indicator Powerhouse Films Blu-ray Collection Fan Group, Powerhouse Films site is having a sale on Monday, April 8th. Check it out, and if there's something on sale, you can thank me, and if there's nothing, then you missed out. How about that?
Let's use this time then to talk a little bit about other podcasts. We both are participating in other podcasts. We mentioned some earlier, but I'm not sure all of them. I was on Terra at Collinwood with Penny Dreadful, and Steve Turek and I talked about the Monsters of Dark Shadows.
Let me just reference how wonderful Penny Dreadful is. She invited me to be on that, and I'm not the Dark Shadows expert. I graciously said, I just don't know what I could offer. I really want to just hear the three of you cover it and do well. She was incredibly, incredibly pleasant. It said that I was still invited to attend. She said some wonderful things. So thank you. I think I made the right call in that I just don't feel I'd have been adequate enough. I mean, you are a huge Dark Shadows fan, and Steve watched the entire series in like a day and a half. Has that memory like a steel trap, as you said?
You are getting ready to participate in another podcast.
I have been asked to return to the Diecast Movie Podcast. He mentioned that he got a movie, actually a set, for super cheap, and that's the Puppet Master Films. You know what? I bought the Puppet Master Films myself a while back in a cheap set. Do you want to do the Puppet Master, the first movie? I was like, yes, absolutely. So we will be talking about the original Puppet Master.
Then I will be recording a few days after you with Steve. We are going to talk about the film Uzumaki or Spiral. It's a Japanese horror film that is visually stunning. I'll just leave it at that. That'll be fun talking about that. Have you ever seen that? Don't get it confused with Spiral with Chris Rock. That's not it.
No, I would not. I want to say no. I think I've heard of it a lot, but I don't think I've seen it. No, I'm not doing any other appearances. I plan on doing some stuff on the blog.
Tell us about that.
Trying to tie in. You know, I did a lot of Todd Slaughter movies last month in the month of April. I'll be doing a few other musicals / rock music films that kind of tie into what we're doing this month. Little Shop of Horrors, I'm going to be covering that over at the site. Also going to be taking a look at Repo, the Genetic Opera. This is where it gets on a little bit on the fringe, but I'm going to be doing Heavy Metal from 1981, which is not a musical, but it features some great rock music. Then I'm going to be doing Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, which is a hard film to find. And I managed to find a copy on archive.org that is from VHS. I don't know that it's actually even been released officially on DVD or not. If it has, it's out of print. It's not an easy film to find. And I probably is now even going to be harder because I just read where Kiss sold all the rights to their music and their characters and persona to some company out of Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, one of those countries in that part of the world for like $500 million, which seems kind of low. The version I found was actually the original NBC TV version. And we didn't talk about that with Rocky Horror. There's actually two versions of that movie. There is a slightly different version, the UK version, which does a few different things, but the ending of Rocky Horror is slightly different and a little more upbeat. They add like another little, I guess it's called Superheroes. They add like another mini musical number. Pans back and you see Brad and Janet lying on the ground. They actually are moving around and singing and stuff. Doesn't really change the end of the movie much. Some people say that it makes it a little more uplifting because it doesn't look like Brad and Janet are dead. I didn't think that they were dead personally. I just thought that they were in shock because they kind of were on the edge of the blast.
And I am doing horror comedies of the 80s. These are the spoofs of not necessarily just the slasher movies, but some general monster movies. This experience reminds me of why I don't like horror comedies. Last year I did it and I found a couple gems, especially Student Bodies. So far, that's not happening now. And I do everything chronologically. So, of course, these are like the copies of the copies and...
Thankfully, you're not going out of the 80s because then you might do the Scary Movie franchise.
Oh, yeah. No.
That franchise almost broke me. And then when I went to the theater to see Meet the Spartans, because my son wanted to go see that, I honestly don't think I've ever left a theater more irritated than I was that I sat and watched Meet the Spartans. It was about 70 minutes at best, and then like 10 minutes at the end of outtakes that really... should have been part of the movie anyway. Wouldn't have helped the movie. It was a horrible film.
Should we tell people what we're doing next month so they can begin their homework?
I believe we shall. And they might have a little bit of a trick on this one here, which surprises me.
Yeah.
When we decided to do these movies, I thought they would be a little bit easier to find. Oh my gosh, we got a new ape movie, Planet of the Ape movie, coming out next month. We really should properly do the first two films in the original franchise. Way back, I think in episode 16.5, we did a Planet of the Ape episode where we kind of gave our thoughts on the franchise, I think, and talked about our experiences. Most of it was some audio that you got from an amazing trip you took out to see some props and such in a live presentation in California. I think that'll be a wonderful companion episode to next month. That one is actually on our current feed. I think it's the oldest episode on the feed. We're going to be taking a look at the first two films in the franchise, Planet of the Apes from 1968 and Beneath the Planet of the Apes in 1970. I know that this means I've got to watch the rest of the franchise and probably revisit the current franchise before the new film, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which is a whole different timeline. I think I've enjoyed the films, so I'm looking forward to the new one. These two films, if you want to play along at home, it's only streaming on Stars. There's a Legacy Collection DVD set that you can get for about $25, which will give you, I believe, all of the five films. If you want to get this on Blu-ray, the set that I have apparently has gone out of print. I think there was even another set that's gone out of print. If you go through Amazon, they're charging like $45 for a Blu-ray there. But if you go to eBay and shop around, you can get the movies, at least the first movie, for like $15 on Blu-ray. And for not a crazy amount of price, you can get all five of the original films in the franchise on Blu-ray. Don't just go to Amazon on this one. Do some shopping around on eBay. I think you can find the films out there at a reasonable price. Talking about next month in anticipation of the new Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes film, which
you
I know
missed an opportunity there, Richard.
Oh, no.
What did you just say? Can you remember?
I don't know. What did I just, I don't
you
know.
Said it, you said the word anticipation.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I missed the opportunity.
Want to give it an effort or?
No.
Okay.
It's gone. Moment's gone. I'll just say another opportunity that I missed, and I'm going to add this in, but it seems like such an afterthought. Next month, we're going to Go Ape, which, you know, was the major promotion of it.
Yes.
Poster on my wall that says Go Ape. That's what we're doing next month. We're going to Go Ape.
Well, I think we can wrap this one up.
Next month, we'll get back to the serious business of
apes talking apes.
Yeah, the apocalypse and talking apes. Absolutely.
It won't take a genius to figure out or predict what our song going out will be. We started with one from Rocky Horror, so we're going to go out with one from Phantom of the Paradise. This is Phantom's theme, Beauty and the Beast. It's by Paul Williams from the original soundtrack recording of Phantom of the Paradise, copyright A&M Records. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next month.
Take care, everyone.
Half asleep, I hear a voice. Is it only in my mind? Is it someone calling me? Someone I failed and left behind. To work it out, I let them in. All the good guys and the bad guys that I've been. Together in midnight.